Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. From the NBC newsroom in San Francisco, the National Broadcasting Company opens today's coverage of world events from our reporters on the scene. For news of the war in the Pacific, we'll hear first from Sidney Albright in Java. We take you now to Batavia.
Hello, NBC. This is Sidney Albright speaking in Batavia, Java. The time here is 8:30 Saturday evening. The key position in the western part of the Pacific for the near future is occupied by the Netherlands East Indies. From this point, Allied fighting forces can remain a constant threat to the enemy. And from this point, they can start an offensive action the moment the opportune time arrives. Of all countries in Southeast Asia, the Netherlands Indies possess the most powerful fighting forces on land as well as at sea and in the air. It also has military leaders who have demonstrated that they understand the art of war to perfection. And it is inspired with an offensive spirit, the only spirit that is capable of ultimately beating the enemy. With this passage, one of the leading papers in the Indies, the Priangaboda, opens an editorial on the position of the Netherlands Indies in the Allied lineup against Japan. The paper continues, recent comments from the United States and the British Empire show that both in Washington and in London, the opinion is gaining ground that the Netherlands Indies are destined to play an important role in the strategy of the Pacific War. The compulsory retreat of American fighting forces in Luzon and the occupation of a large section of Mindanao by the Japanese have created a state of affairs in which the islands of the Indies archipelago not only form the front line, but also the only communication between the supporting points of the battling democracies in the western part of the Pacific, Singapore and Australia. It is not improbable that the Australian arguments have played a part in determining the attitude of the men conferring in Washington. Right from the very start, Canberra has had a clear insight into the economic and strategic significance of the Netherlands Indies. The new contact, which has grown between Australia and the Indies in the course of the last 8 months, has certainly helped to convince the Australian government, the military leaders, and public opinion that the Indies and Australia, in many respects, form an economic and strategic unit, which, if broken, would have fatal consequences for both territories. If the Indies were to fall into the hands of the enemy, the greater part of the Japanese forces would be released for operations elsewhere. We have in mind Siberia, British India, and even the west coast of the United States. Japan's weak point is, and will continue to be, its supply of materials. For Japan's conduct of the war, the Netherlands Indies are at least as important as the Caucasus are for Germany. Never before in history have the Indies been of such tremendous importance as now. Located between two oceans and two continents, it occupies a predominant position. Not only the outcome of the Pacific War, but also in a high measure that of the present world-embracing conflict depends on the preservation of the Netherlands Indies. The article continues, let's hope that this will be understood by those who are at present deciding the Allied strategy. The Indies will do its duty. Since December 8th, it has given conclusive proof of this. The Indies will do more than its duty. Its men will fight to the last drop of blood in defense of the empire. We shall try to set a good example. We cannot do more than that. We hope that the significance of our fight will be realized. In conclusion, the paper says, we are counting on the means to bring the war to a successful conclusion being sent to us as soon as possible and in the greatest possible quantities. The so-called Netherlands Empire radio programs, conducted by the broadcasting stations in occupied Holland, which generally do not interest the people of the NEI, sometimes give out fantastic and amusing statements, obviously instigated by Nazi pressure. Last Friday, the announcer gave a news item reading, yesterday's Tokyo papers published the latest news photos of Japanese soldiers guarding the oil fields in Borneo, dressed in their new uniforms. The Japanese readers living in the midst of the alleged new order in East Asia are probably meant to believe that those photographs were actually taken in Borneo. Too bad that these readers do not know that their countrymen were unable to find a single drop of oil in Sarawak on northwest Borneo. The Japanese occupying forces had brought with them, optimistically, a huge tanker, hoping to fill it up. But according to reliable information, this tanker is now being used as a shelter against the constant rain of Dutch bombs being dropped on Miri. It is not unlikely that the proud Japanese soldiers in their new uniforms, instead of obtaining precious oil, are fighting the fires that greeted them.
You've been listening to Sidney Albright in Batavia, Java. From the NBC Newsroom in San Francisco, we take you now to New York.
Now from the NBC newsroom in New York, we have a dispatch from Moscow. The Russian government has issued an appalling statement on the slaughter of the German army. The Soviet government says that every 24 hours, 2,500 German soldiers are meeting death. That was the rate of the slaughter for the last week in December, and there has been no let-up in the fierce Russian assaults. Now let's switch across the Atlantic and get the report of NBC staff member in London.
John McVane speaking. London today learned from Singapore that the Japanese are putting more and more pressure on the Perak front of Malaya. They made three attacks yesterday in this area, but each time the British threw them back with total losses estimated at 400 to 500. You know that yesterday the Japanese were reported to have landed troops further down the peninsula. They tried another landing that seems to have struck a strong point in the British defenses. Fire from British artillery set a small Japanese steamer afire, sank four barges, and drove off the rest of the Japanese ships. The Japanese are reported to be in the outskirts of Kuantan, trying to seize the aerodrome. The Admiralty today disclosed that a British convoy of 30 ships was under attack for 5 days. Two merchant ships were sunk, and the Navy lost two vessels, the destroyer Stanley and the auxiliary vessel Audacity. At least three U-boats were sunk. Two German long-range bombers were shot down into the sea, and a third severely damaged. The Germans had claimed destruction of 9 merchant ships. The Admiralty announced earlier today that the 7,000-ton cruiser Neptune and the 1,600-ton destroyer Kandahar have been sunk by mines in the Mediterranean. British bombers last night raided the ports of Brest and Saint-Nazaire in occupied France. Speaking of raids, don't forget that members of the Allied Air Forces are doing good work with the British flyers. For instance, Captain Morley of the Free French destroyed his 18th enemy plane yesterday, a Messerschmitt that he shot down near the coast of his homeland. He returned to his base, then flew back over Boulogne to see the plane he'd shot down burning in the town. The British are pleased at last night's announcement of the signing of the 26-power declaration. The average person feels that the news is formal recognition of that fact that most of the world is at war with the Axis. The declaration, it's felt, is a diplomatic lining up of our forces that parallels what's being done with the Allied armies, navies, and air forces. The British have become more realistic these last months, and a general reaction of the type of person who doesn't spend much time studying international affairs has been, the declaration is good, but what are our armies and navies going to do about the Far East? The Daily Telegraph calls the Washington Treaty the writing on the wall for Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo. The paper says, beside this Treaty of Washington, the Tripartite Pact of Berlin must appear a puny affair even to its own authors and to the Quislings who have made it ridiculous with their servile signatures. The Liberal News Chronicle emphasizes that it is when an aggressor has begun to weaken that such public affirmations of solidarity among its opponents have the most crushing moral effect. How can it be anything but disturbing for a citizen of the Reich, the News Chronicle goes on, to know that half the world is indissolubly united to bring about the defeat of his country? What should we feel if this declaration were directed against us, and if we knew that behind the joint pledge were the joint resources of so large a section of mankind? The paper adds, this declaration holds out hope of more than victory. All the nations concerned have voluntarily subscribed to the principles of the Atlantic Charter. They plan to work together in peace as well as war for common ends. A new League of Nations is arising under better auspices. Colonel Britton, who talks over the British radio to the peoples of the occupied countries, had a rap night last night. He gave the names of some of the French, Belgian, Dutch, Norwegian, and Czech Quislings. He told what they're doing and said, they're playing a dangerous game, more dangerous than some of them think. We're watching them. Colonel Britton warned Belgians that Captain Vermoylen, a Belgian Air Force officer who lives on the Avenue Louvain in Brussels, is betraying his own countrymen for money. Colonel Britton said, he pretends he will help young Belgians escape to London, and then denounces them to the authorities. For this, he is usually paid 2,000 francs. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the news in the British capital. The news in our own capital is reported now by Earl Godwin, speaking from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. Here it is, the last week of the old year and the first of the new year, all in one. There's 4 days out of the old era, or epoch, and 3 days of a new epoch, and here we are. And that seems to be, to me, to be the designation of this moment right now, the day after the signing of that 26th United Nations Pact against a worldwide threat to white freedom from the world. Can't help it, even if London did scoop me a little on this Washington story. It is the thing which everybody here is talking about after they get through talking about the motor car and tire situation. But I commend to each one of you the reading of that brief pact which 26 nations signed, headed with this signature. Not Franklin D. Roosevelt, but he wrote with his fountain pen, "The United States of America" by Franklin D. Roosevelt. And 25 others came along, signed by Winston Churchill for the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, all that written in pen. And so on down the line. Other nations signed by their ambassadors or their ministers, including the exiled governments which are keeping on so valiantly. And there was the little Duchy of Luxembourg, and the peppy and aggressive Costa Rica, and the vast domain of India, and of course all the others, each one of which signed and seemed to just burled and burst forward to get and sign on the dotted line on this promise and this pact and this uniting in one purpose. I commend to your attention this pact because of its meaning, and again because of the simplicity and the brevity and the strength of its language. It promises that all the world outside the pest holes of Hitlerism and its allied poison will devote all its energy, all the world other than the Axis, all its energy and resources to wiping out this pot of poison, that none of these United Nations will quit fighting in a separate peace. For a tremendous purpose, the document is wonderfully brief. If I were you, I'd read and learn. Congress, which was in session all of 1941, 365 days, as well as all of the leap year 1940, rests today, starts the second session of the 77th Congress on Monday. It will be ready to receive the President and his message on the State of the Union, if he cares to go there in person, and I think possibly he will, and his budget will go on the next day after the message. It's commonly believed to be $50 billion for the fiscal year, which starts July 1st. Think of spending, preparing, and working at $1 billion a week. And it'll be more than that, I think. Other congressional matters are ready to roll right along. Don't make fun of your Congress. It is doing a swell job and working hard. The half-done price control bill is ready, almost for Senate debate. A stronger bill has been written and prepared than that passed by the House. And some of these worried senators, the conservative ones, are ready to press for a strong anti-strike law. The House has already passed a strong anti-strike bill, the Smith bill. Behind the scenes, two Appropriations Committee members have had a peep at the budget and are ready with their spending bills. Leon Henderson, now master over production and prices and your car and tires, believes the need for American motors for the war may make it necessary to commandeer your private cars. He permits 200,000 cars to be made in January instead of 100,000. After that, no more cars until after the war, so he says now. The CIO, which offered a graduated plan of converting the motor industry into a war munitions industry, comes up this morning with full-page advertising criticizing and blasting OPM something awful. CIO says we've lost 2 million man days a week through failure to convert the automobile manufacturing industry gradually into a war munitions industry, and that the whole business of this sudden industrial jerk and blackout and no more cars arises from poor management and the policy of business as usual, and that's all from Washington at this time.
In addition to Mr. Godwin, you heard John McVane from London and Sidney Albright from Batavia. This is the National Broadcasting Company.